This is tape three, side one, of an interview with Mrs. Hyla Osh Foreman.
Yes. When my mother brought me this sack home, cotton sack, I took a pencil, this violet pencil, and I meshed it. I made it in powder, and I boiled water, and I colored the sack violet, purple. And by hand, I made myself a little dress. This was my dress that I went dancing with. This is the only thing on my feet. I had a pair of slippers, what I made it myself from pieces of cotton and the other, and I didn't have no socks. But I was young, nothing mattered, only to survive.
Now, this dancing group you mentioned before.
No, not group. In every town, refugee young people meet.
Yes.
They used to sing songs, playing on balalaikas, dancing, you know, these kind of things.
These were all Jewish refugees that you're talking
yes.
about?
Yes, yes. So I knew that, let's say, three kilometers, this would be like 2 miles.
Mm-hmm.
It's their group. You can meet the other people and go together and dancing. So with this violet dress, like a jumper style, with the cotton slippers, material fabric slippers,
mm-hmm.
I went for dancing. I remember one day I get an attack of malaria, middle of the road. I used to lay down on the road, on the sidewalk, lay down for half an hour until it stopped shaking. And then you're all sweat after the shaking stops for malaria, you're all sweat out. I wiped my face, I straightened out, and I continued my way to the dancing. This is things I will never forget, like I never forget up till today. When I am in a bathtub, that I had lice, and when I open up my bed sheets, they are clean, the flowers, beautiful, that they are clean, and that for 3 years I didn't see a piece of soap. This is things some people forgot. I can. When I see these things, I cannot forget. And still today, maybe this is the reason I'm a little fat. I'm aching. I'm sick when I have to throw out food. I cannot do that. I don't know why. I'm full, but I cannot throw it out. I'll keep it in the refrigerator maybe for longer, and then I'll throw it. I can't. That's the whole life. Because I was stealing from a garden. Cucumbers, tomatoes, with the mud, with everything, but I didn't carry them out. I was wiping out the mud like this and eating up at night in the vegetable garden. And it's another thing, what means strength. All my youth I suffered from colitis. I couldn't eat cucumbers, raw vegetables, not drinking milk. I was terrible with colitis. But the moment I start my pilgrimage as a refugee, I ate everything. And I was healthy like a, how would you say, like a, I don't know the expression. Gesund wie a Pferd. Nothing. I was eating raw, dirty cucumbers. Nothing happened to me. Sometimes it was a time that I was praying to God to get sick, to get a leaf, or you say it, free for 2-3 days from work on the fields. Sometimes was, my God, in the hospital at least I'll have a bed, because in Asia we slept on the floor. They don't sleep on beds, they don't eat on tables. Usually they sleep only on the floor.
Mm.
They have a lot of blankets, quilted blankets, and they are sleeping on them.
Mm.
And people from the little village gave for the refugees old blankets for everyone, and it has holes. You know, the cotton is outside.
What was the attitude of the villagers towards you, the natives?
In the beginning, very good. In the beginning. I mean, they respected us, European. They considered themselves Mongolian, Asians. They respected us very, very much. Until young Uzbeks start coming back from the front. Start talking, they are killing their Jews. It has to be a reason for that.
Mm.
they start introducing the hate they got on the front. They start looking differently. That even I remember an expression from a young Uzbek, because I spoke beautiful Uzbek language. I learned it fast and I forgot it very fast. And they used to, I remember he said, why do they say in Germany that every Jew has a long nose? Stupid expressed question, but they came already with the poison inside them, because they were together with the soldiers there on the fronts from Germany, from even the population from Ukraine was hating Jews. So being with Ukrainian people together, the Uzbek with Ukrainian soldiers and with other soldiers, some came back from the hospitals, they were wounded, they had inside all the seeds of antisemitism. This started approximate 43, middle 43, after the Russians start throwing them back from Stalingrad. Mm-hmm. There was a big battle in 43 from Stalingrad, and the Russians start going back, throwing back the Germans. Then a lot of soldiers came, the territories were freed, the Germans were already in their territories.
The Germans were in the territory where you were living?
Not in Asia, no. There was the back for, but they, when the Russians start going back, throwing their back, they freed Ukraine, they freed the Krasnodar, they freed these places. Mm-hmm. And the population there was already full of poison from the Germans. Mm-hmm. Because the Ukrainians are anti-Semitic, and a lot of people are anti-Semitic, the Russian people. So they got, a good teachings from the being occupied by the Germans.
How did this change the villagers' behavior towards you once the soldiers came back?
They usually, to me personally, was different. I'll say why and generally. They use their life. If you know, the Uzbeks are still like the Islam, their religion was Islam before the Russians came in. I mean, they still have the mosques, but this is the way. The door is always open. If a stranger passes by, he can come in. And if they are eating in that time, he asks them to the table. You know? Sometimes I was looking where is going, smoke. So then you know that they're eating. So you know you're always welcome to go to eat with them together. They're eating from one plate of pilaf, you put your finger, everyone is from the same plate. Mm-hmm. Everybody's drinking the tea, the herb tea from the same cup. It's not a cup, it's like a bowl. And you're sipping and you give to your other one, the other one's sipping, give to the third one. They're so around sitting around the table. And the wife is never together with the husband, like in Islam. She is near the oven, she feeds the kids, they have a lot of kids, they feed the kids, and the husband with friends, with other, but when an European person came, I'm a woman, they still invited me to sit together with them.
So the European women were included, even though their own weren't?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was a little, change. But when it started, this part of feeling a little anti-Semitic or rejection of the refugee, I will take it all together. They stopped inviting you. You could pass by, and if you went in, do you wish something, you want something, and send them away. Not inviting anymore to the this. The tone was a little different from the Uzbek people. For myself was a little different. Why? I invented an idea to survive. They put on little hats for the babies. Usually their babies have always all kind of skin problems, eye problems, you know, that kind of, this, because the cleanliness, the hygiene is not, little babies, you can see them with things on their head, shaved, the head is shaved, because even the men are shaved. And they use always to close them up with little bonnets, good on, bad on. I took a skirt from my mother, I tore it apart, and I saw little bonnets. and on the top little buttons or something, a plain button from a pants I could put on the top or other things. And I used to take this little bonnet. When I saw the smoke coming out, I brought a little gift for you for the baby. Then they invited me already for, it was a little different. Or I was sitting with a wife and she gave me a little bowl with this kind of soup or whatever it is. It was really, you are so inventive to survive that nobody can even imagine this kind of things, that a person can be so inventive for this kind of things. And this helped me out for a certain time in the cooperative. Then I found out that I can, they found out for me that I am, how you call it, I can sew. And they took me in a sewing cooperative. And again, a man with the arm outside. Because everything we were sewing there was sent to the, it was for the army.
Was this in the same?
No, it was, this was a kolkhoz and this was like a town, a little town. The name was Begovat.
How do you spell that?
B-E-G-O-V-A-T. I still correspond with some people what I met in Begovat. Coming into to in this cooperative, they were sewing, how are you saying, not shirts, not pyjamas and not shirts, like what you put on for a soldier when he's in the hospital, like a cover-up, a top and a pair of pants. You had to make the norm to get your bread is 48 shirts in 8 hours. 48 shirts. They're coming from the cutter, and you are making it. And imagine a machine in 1942. They still didn't have automatic machines. With the feet, you have to go with your feet in the machine sewing. And how can you make a norm when you go by the machine with your feet like this? But I achieved 56 shirts and I got 100 gram more bread. This was my achievement for making more shirts. Then we start sewing quilted jackets for the soldiers, for the army. And I was very good on them. Knowing the Uzbek language, they chose me to go and learn textile. And I said, textile? I'll get food in the school, the best place to go. All this was, the mind in your head didn't go work for nothing. At night, at day, when you're awake, only food. This was the only thing a person could think of. Food.
You were separated from your mother at the point
yes.
that you went to the sewing cooperative.
Yes. Yes, yes. A little later, I took her, she came to my place. I was living in a, how would you call it, under the underground barracks. Like you see them in the cold countries, they make it underground. 60 people in a barrack. People dying in that barrack. People, kids were born in this barrack. And we lived separated by like straw mats between the families. And then when I got this, I brought my mother to me, and we lived there.
Were you still with primarily Jewish refugees?
Yes,
other Jewish, cooperative as well?
Jewish refugees.
Was there any kind of ritual that was practiced, any Jewish ritual?
I will tell you, when it came, we didn't know almost dates when something is happening. The only thing we knew when it's Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And we had a guy between us, who he was the cantor. And in a house, we were practicing Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur prayings. And after a while, this guy who prayed was, they didn't arrest all the people who came to the synagogue. They arrested the cantor. And he was sent away to Siberia or whatever, who knows where he went. They couldn't arrest 200 people for practicing. But if they will arrest the cousin, nobody to make the prayers anymore. They're the same system. So the cousin was arrested. Then we had another guy, but we were praying without books. Because without books, if somebody from the older ones remembered, they were saying and they were listening, because we didn't have sidurim at all, nothing. And in a house we were praying. And another thing, every day in another house, because it was illegal. So every day we went in another house. If they catch us, it is the first time. So always we went in another house.
What else did you celebrate besides the high holidays?
Besides the high holidays, we knew when it's Pesach, but we didn't have any matzah because this wasn't very far away. Maybe the Jews in the big towns like Tashkent had it because the synagogue's there and it's a Jewish community there. And the Bukharan Jews, the Jews of Bukhara, they're very, how you say, practicing Jews. Maybe there, yes, but not where I was.
Were you able to get any news of what was happening in Europe?
We only had the news, I tell you, in this Begovat, I married my first husband. He was working, he didn't have a lot of Jews, the marrying kind, you know what I mean? And he was the only one there, a good worker. Stachanovitz is one who makes more than the norm. You know what this is? This is a very big title in Russia, to work more than they ask for. He was working very hard, and he left a wife and a child in Poland. And when we met, we said to each other, if your wife and child survives, you are free to decide whatever you want to do. At least now we are together. Why did we say that? In that time, in 1942, it was formed an army from Polish citizens in Russia to go and fight on the Polish territory against the Germans. It was called Polska Armia. So a lot of them went to the fronts. And a lot of them, after, if they were wounded, they were in the hospitals in Russia. So they brought the news that the Jews were killed, ovens, concentration camps, not direct ovens like we knew later on, that the Jewish population were killed by the Nazis. My ex-husband had a family with 7 brothers. Nobody's alive. Absolutely nobody. And the friends told us what's going on there. So then we decided that if his wife or his child will survive after the war, or somebody will be, because my ex-husband always dreamt that his child is somewhere between non-Jews. So when we came back after the war, I was the one to look in the newspapers, to look in organizations, to ask in churches, maybe, because he was 5 years old, I think, 4 or 5 years old, the little boy, when he left. And he left because their father, their town was occupied by the Nazis in Poland. And they cut away his beard together with a piece of his flesh, of his face. He was an old man. He went very too early to the synagogue. So he took his sons and he gave him a wagon and he said, you have to run away. Old people and children, and women, they won't do nothing. So all the brothers ran away, but they were on the border and they didn't let them cross to the Russians. Everybody went back to their families and they were killed by the Germans. Only one, my husband, the only son who came other side and survived. He's still alive, he's in Israel.
He snuck over the
father of my son.
He snuck over the border.
Yes. Yes.
His name was?
Pesach. They call him known as Paul. Pesach.
And his last name?
Ziskind. This is the name of my children. Ziskind. And so we knew after this Polish soldiers came back, what happened, more or less we knew that the Jews were killed. They had concentration camps, labor camps, but nobody knew about extermination camps.
Not until after the war?
Because labor camps were in Russia too. Mm-hmm. We knew that they concentrated the Jews because we knew even in the 32, 33, 34 that they had concentration camps in Germany. We knew about concentration camps on all the territories he occupied, but nobody knew about extermination. If somebody died or he was killed, or he was, because he was against Nazism, he was a communist, you know, or he died because of sickness or starvation, but nobody knew about extermination camp, about the gases and about this kind. Nobody knew about that until we came back from Russia to Poland. Thanks to that my ex-husband was Polish citizen, we could leave Russia as an exchange of citizens. After the war, Russia made an exchange. All Russians on the territory there came back, and all the Polish people on the Russian territory was sent back, if you want, back to Poland.
And you were included in that?
I was included because I was married to him. I usually, after the wedding, the marriage, I married him, I still used my Averbuch, my maiden name, but when we found out that Polish people can leave, I right away changed my name and his name so we could leave the country. And I took my mother with me too.
Let's back up for a minute.
Yes, dear.
You married him in 1942.
Yes.
And you were living at this time still in the area where you were...
Can I make a correction?
Sure.
I married him in 1943.
In 1943. Was he also working in the same commune as you?
No, he wasn't. This I met him there where I was sewing in Begovat. This was a little town.
Yes.
He was an auto mechanic. He worked as an auto mechanic. Worked as auto mechanic. And I tell you what I found him. They found out that I know to write and read Russian language, so they took me out from the sewing department, and they put me on a department what built it a, how you call it, metallurgic factory, where they're making steel, in a steel factory. Oh, you call it? It's not called factory.
Mill.
Steel mill. Yes. I became there a clerk, all of a sudden. Knowing Russian language, they made me a clerk. Because in this 5 years I was there, 41, 45, which I left, went through so many trades and so many things, you know, that I sometimes say, only 2 months I was this, only 3 months I was that. It's not you cannot imagine what it is. And I was, a clerk. This clerk means, how will you call somebody who checks if the working people are on their jobs? Mm-hmm. This is a job in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
You go around with a book with names, finding out if the people are on their jobs. If they are not on the jobs, you have to find out where they are. If they are sick, they have to bring a paper from the doctor. If they are not sick, they are declared deserters. Because the whole life in Russia and the war was a front. And if you didn't come for 3-4 days to your job, if you came with a certain paper or whatever it is, then I had to make a report as a deserter. This was my job. So I went on the rails from the train, what were carrying the steel and all kinds, it's checking on 2,000, more than 2,000 people if they are on their jobs. And I used to tell them, it was so hard for me to make a report as a deserter. I could die. How can I write such a thing? I used to tell him, if you have to do something, you have to go to the market to sell your cow, because it was Uzbek people working there. If your wife is pregnant and you want to help, your guard, whatever you have to do, tell me. Tell me, so if the head will ask me what is this and this and this? You say, he asked permission, he's there and there. Not leave your job without saying what you're doing, where you are. If no, I have to make the declaration as a deserter. So the Uzbeks loved me enormously, and I start living up. In what sense? One Uzbek brought me a dozen eggs. One Uzbek, a peasant, brought me a little, like a handkerchief, a little rice or whatever it is. One, you know, it was, and this helped me a lot. Then came the time that I married my, he was a mechanic on this mill, auto mechanic. Because I could think about such a thing because I wasn't hungry anymore like I was before. And I start meeting this, and I start preparing groups for amateur, for performing. Why did it? Because they used to give, they didn't pay for that, but they give, how you call it, a prize, a premium, 3 yards of fabric, a pair of American shoes. They got from America for the army soldier shoes. So if I won a prize, they gave me a pair of American soldier shoes.
Who are you referring to now? Who is they who could give
Russians,
this prize?
Russian people, the government.
The government itself.
Government is the government.
So
if I call they, it's Russia.
It's Russia. So you started an amateur...
Not I started. I start preparing, let's say, they have a big holiday, May the 1st. May 1st is a holiday. November the 7th is a holiday. I mean, state holiday. And they have amateur groups that they are preparing for, entertaining for this holiday. Let's say a man is speaking about the first May, about the working people, you know how it's called. And then comes a little entertaining, a little concert. So we didn't have concert, but for this occasion I had like in all Jewish guys, a group of Jewish boys and girls, some married, some had a little baby, and we made a little review. And we made a little Jewish and a little Russian, all together, small ones. And I got a pair of American boots from a soldier. I sold them in a market, and I bought for myself some other thing. This was already in 43, as long as the Russians stopped pushing the Germans.
They let you do this?
They had this amateur, they had amateur groups, talents who went to perform for the soldiers. It was, they wouldn't send Jews there. They wouldn't send Russian refugees there. They send their actors good actors from Moscow, Leningrad, and Kharkov. They were groups like you send it here in Vietnam, they send it on the front to perform from their soldiers.
Did you have any knowledge of what was happening with the Yiddish theater during those years in Russia?
It wasn't, it didn't exist. It wasn't. In that years, the Moscow, even the government of the actors of Moscow was in Tashkent. They had sometimes concerts on single basis. I know some actors who stayed in Tashkent, worked with a show or two from time to time, semi-professional. The government didn't give them all the support. Something the rest they have to make from the people. But this happened in a big town like Tashkent. Tashkent is like the Moscow of Asia, of Middle Asia, what is there. And we didn't dream about performing where I was. But in 43, why? I got 3 yards of Japanese silk because they had Japanese prisoners of war in there. And they used me, I understood Italian a little bit because on this mill, what I said, steel mill, they start bringing in 43 prisoners from Germany and from Italy. I know Romanian language, I understood very well Italian. I know German perfectly. So they start using me to translate from the prisoners of war, help me. The worst prisoners were the Japanese prisoners. They chose always death instead of working for the Russians. They used to kill themselves. They were put in wagons to go to work. They used to throw themselves out of the trains. They were honorable dead. Mm-hmm. You know, the honorable dead. Mm-hmm. and every Japanese had silk on his body, certain amount of 5 or 6 yards, I don't know, meter of silk, because when you bury a Japanese, he's buried in the silk. So started coming on the market in Russia, Japanese silk. All of a sudden, we had Japanese silk, how much you want. Because if the Japanese died, the Russian buried it without the silk. The silk came on the market. And I remember I had a dress from 3 yards. I bought on the market 3 yards of black silk with a little flower. I made myself a dress. So every day, a person that survived the war could write a book. Because in the morning, it's not the same like in the mid of the day, in the night, not the same as in the morning, and the next day, not the same like the day before.
This is tape 3, side 2 of an interview with Mrs. Chaya Ashforman.
Yes. And this is the way our life was approximate till the beginning of 45, when we had more news what's going on, that the Russians are coming closer to Germany. Mm-hmm. And the life start a little easier, even in Russia. Only first, maybe we got used, maybe we learned what to do to survive. Second one, we got all the time news what's going on there in Germany, and we were thinking, we are poor, we are hungry, but at least we survived. Who knows what is better? All kind of things in the heads. And everybody start living with the idea, maybe the war will soon be finished and you come back and we'll find somebody from your families, from your relatives. And this way of thinking makes your life a little bit easier too. So in 45, when it came when we heard that the war finished and the Russians are in Berlin.
At this time, You were still in the same town?
Same town.
And your mother at this point was
mother
with you?
Us, with mm-hmm. me, with me.
And had you found out about your father by now?
But I found out in, he died in 42, end of 42. In 43, 10 days after he died, somebody came from, I told you before Fergana, Margellan, mm-hmm. they came to me and said, and I said, how is my daddy doing? And they say, what do you mean? You don't know that he's dead? Not to announce, they knew where the family is, not to say, not to announce, not to let, nothing. He disappeared one night, then I went there and found out that there were 50 people in one grave, in one hole, with this antiseptic on the top, covered up without even a stone, with nothing. This is the way my father is there, somewhere. This is what a lot later. And really, when the war finished, we start thinking how we are going out. They could keep us here forever, because we have no connection with the government for this kind of asking. When do we let me go? What do you mean go? You stay here. If not, you cannot ask even such questions a government. We want to go back. But all of a sudden we found out that it's an exchange of citizens going on from the other towns, we found out. And it was the head of Polish government. Polish people don't let other nations to go over them, or you would say to boss over them. Because when all the Polish people arrived in Russia and the Russians want to give him passports, they didn't want to accept him. If you heard about it, they took only permanent 6 monthly, and to renew him every 6 months, because they didn't accept the Russian citizenship.
And this is what your husband had done?
And yes, they didn't accept citizenship. A lot of them went to Siberia, a lot were sent away in the forests or other things. But when the war started, they were let out from the prisons, because the Polish people got passports, Russian passports, in 39 they started giving them, when Germany occupied half and the Russians half. So a lot of Polish people were sent to prisons, to labor camps. And then they were freed. As soon as the war started, these Polish people were freed. They started working. That's the way my husband was. And so they heard the Polish people start talking to the Russians of exchanging. It didn't came from the people, from the Polish people who are in Russia. It came from the Polish people from Poland. Mm-hmm. For an exchange. So we went and registered. But you had to wait till they will give to your disposition a train. So we were waiting for months. It was already 45 October or November that they said the Begovat got a train to load the refugees. So we were again in this kind of wagons. In this train, you call it wagon, or you call
the train car.
Train car, in a train car, what they are usually using for cattle. In the middle, a little oven, iron oven, and all the people inside. And we were traveling 1 month to the Polish border. They put us away for weeks on the deadline. People didn't have what to eat. They start again running in town, buying something. And do you know how many murders was? Jewish people went down in the little villages, in the Ukrainian villages on the road, to buy food, and they didn't come back. They killed them there. We find out later on. The same thing happened on the Polish territory. When we went over the border, we had a paper, half Polish, half Russian. And when we came to the border, they came on the train and they cut away, they tear apart the two pieces. we got the Polish part, they took away the Russian part, and we went over the border on the Polish side. And the train brought us in small villages. And again, the same thing on the way. Some people I know, a musician, a trumpetist, a fantastic trumpetist, went down in town to buy something and he was killed. It's fact. He left his wife and children in the train. They have to continue their journey without father.
Not knowing what had happened?
Some people told us. They were the Polish partisans who after the war still were going around in the forest and in the fields and this, and killing Jews. And this was this old people were called Aka. I don't even know what it means, the shortening of what words, but I remember they were called Akovtses, Aka.
What initials? A.
A. K. A. I would say. Maybe they wrote it differently. Aka was this people who. Good luck. Okay, mom. Geg is in the raid and good luck. Whatever it is, to be good. They called him for an interview in Bank Leumi because he worked in bank in Israel. And here is a bank. Oh, look, listening here. When we came to the Polish territory, we found out that a lot of pogroms, a lot of things are going on against Jews. Because if a Jew came to a little town asking, making a little, you know, searching for his family, for his house he grew up, etc. If he were good, some people, it happened, they got scared. Look, he survived, what happened? And they didn't do him nothing. Some were afraid that he will take away, they had already Polish people living in his house or having their factory or having their business. So very often they were killed. They never could go. And everyone felt on the territory of Poland that they could never stay there. It's like only a transit. They would like to find out what happened and go away. Nobody, at least the all who was in the train with us, had in their mind to come back home and continue their life in Poland. Nobody. Some of them who were communistic inclined and other things, or they got a big job, or their wives were not Jewish, and they find out maybe they survived in Russia or in the war because they were saved from non-Jewish girls. They founded families and they didn't want to continue further, so they stayed in Poland. A lot of them stayed in Poland. And then they left later on through the years. A lot of them are in America, a lot of them Australia, other places. But it was very hard. I remember my ex-husband used to say, every Jew feels like the earth is burning under their feet. They couldn't. It was impossible to go around. You could move over in another town. Most of the people moved over to the territory what Germany gave to the Polish, to Poland. It's called Silesia. And all Poland took over Silesia. It's a part of Germany. So I lived in Waldbrzych.
This is the area where you...
Yeah, lived. Silesia. I lived in Silesia. Nobody wants to say Poland. Nobody stayed in Warsaw and lodged in this. Everybody moved over to Silesia, like a bridge from there to go away. And everyone who left with the Bricha on the way to Israel comes from Silesia. Because from there it was very close. Innsbruck. From Innsbruck through Italy to Israel. This was the route that everybody dreamt about it. I became secretary of Policy and CS. This, the Zionist movement had a big committee, helping out with documents and papers and all kind of things to leave the country. Usually, you know what became? Passports from Israeli citizens, they were brought over to Poland. We used to change the pictures, and another group went to Israel.
Now, in the area where you were living,
yeah,
the Poles were not in control, or the Polish people had a different
Poland was in control, but together with the Russians, yes, still.
So that the anti-Semitism was not as...
No, it was dangerous. A very bad anti-Semitism. They were afraid. You can see that a Polak would look on a Jew like, my God, he survived. You know, it was a scary thing for him. You understand? In the same time, it was in a town in Poland, Kielce. It's called Kielce. It was a big pogrom. A whole complex of Jews who lived together, who came back from Russia, who survived from the partisans from Russia, or they were on the Aryan part with Polish documents as a Jew, survived, they were killed. It was a pogrom, officially pogrom. It's called the Kielce pogrom. This was already in 19 in the beginning of 46.
What was different about this area in Silesia that attracted?
It was a mixture of Polish and more Germans. And German people felt very down. Very down. They were suffering from hunger. They didn't have so good like that before. They had to stay in line to have something. Mm-hmm. You talk to them with Norris. You know, that it was a really... you couldn't be afraid. And everyone was saying, not me, not my family, we didn't do with it. They felt very humble. The German people felt they are very humble. But I don't know about the young people, maybe still they have something, activities going on. But I mean the people who live between us, in the markets, in the buildings, in this. Well, German people were very humble and talked beautifully to us. This was the thing.
So the anti-Semitism you were experiencing there was from the Polish people, not from the Germans.
The Germans were very—they were afraid of the Polish people. They were afraid of us. There was a mixture together, mm-hmm. that you felt like an underdog. I remember on the market coming asking for something like underdog. This is what you say, underdog. This is the way they were talking. Very. This was the population of the places they were. And in the same time, in Wrocław, not far from there, they established the Yiddish state theater in Poland, the beginning of a new state theater. Ida Kamińska came then, and this is like a new life, starting a new life.
This town was, again?
Balbzich.
Where you were?
Where I was. It was the capital of Niederschlesia, of lower part of Silesia.
And
it's called in German Niederschlesien.
What is the spelling, do you think?
Balbzich, VWALBRZYCH. This is the real spelling, Balbzich.
And the town where they established the new Yiddish state theater?
Wrocław. It was before... Wrocław. What was the name before? I don't remember.
And that, the name that you just said is spelled?
Wrocław?
Yes.
WROCLAW. This is Wrocław in Polish language written, because this is a C.
From the time that you were in Russia,
yeah.
when you were involved in those small plays, the reviews
yeah.
as you
yeah.
described, did you have any other contact with any kind of Yiddish theater during those years?
Yes, I used to come to Tashkent, and how I came is a story special for itself. Sitting on the steps from the train, I went several times to Tashkent. You know, outside. Sometimes I were beaten up with a broom, a small, you know, the conductor, the broom. And I was sitting outside on the steps, holding my hand like this, wenting from Andijan to Tashkent. And the conductor find out that somebody's sitting there. She start through the window, hitting me on my head with this broom. But I was holding up until I came to Tashkent to meet actors, to see what's going on, to find out what it is. And when I came there, I found out that some actors are performing on semi-professional basis, what I told you before.
Mm-hmm.
And some died, some are still alive, some left the place and went to another place. Maybe they'll find, make it easier for them, better for them. But I always try to come to the bigger town to find out something. But usually you don't find nothing. Radio, you hear only if they took over a town, it was screaming in the radio that Russians took over the town from Germany or from this and this name, the Russians took over this and this and this, and then marches, military marches or whatever. Very seldom some news that you can know what's going on.
Did you find out in Tashkent what was happening with Yiddish publications or the Yiddish writers or any of the Yiddish language issues in
Russia?
I
know that they were, how would you call it, continuing writing some, how would you call it, not written by hand, by machine, and making certain publications for the Jewish not Jewish populations, I wouldn't say, but for the cultural people, some things. But it wasn't in a big, how would I call it, format. I know it was a lot of, many writers were in Tashkent.
And you said the Moscow theater group had come?
Some of them, yes. Mm-hmm. Some of them were in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was Tashkent, and it was Andijan, and it was Kyrgyzstan, and it was Kazakhstan. A lot of states all around where people were spread out. And sometimes not by their own will, because they were sent. Because you can stay here, you cannot stay wherever you want, you have to stay. Even you cannot travel wherever you want in Russia. You have to have a special, that you are free from work, and a special, how you say, that you are allowed to travel.
Permit.
A permit. I know the words, but when I need them, I don't have them. It's hard for me. Yeah.
So, to get back to... Silesia, you were working in this position, helping to get people to Israel.
To get people to Israel, because knowing several languages, they took me in a secretary, because I was speaking with a lot of refugees who came, some even not from Poland. They made, they registered as Polaks with false papers, changed their names only to go out from Russia. A lot of people married fictive to take out somebody from Russia. It was going on. After we heard that you can go out only through Poland, I know for girls who married with guys, they separated up right away after that, but with his papers. If you had a little paper, something to show him that you were in Poland, you are from Poland, then you could go. It can be that you paid your rent. Can be from library. Something, if you had, you could go. So it happens that one had two, three papers. So he would sell one paper for another family, and it was business with that. Selling a little paper only to leave Russia, to come out to Poland. And from Wałbrzych, because we organized groups to go away, and when I lived there, I lived in a kibbutz. The kibbutz wasn't an outer kibbutz. In center city, a big building, the people were living there on the kibbutz way of life. I was kibbutz dror, kibbutz aoved, the organized kibbutzim there. And we were working for the people to go. And in 1947, how do you say in English? I was pregnant. And I said to my husband, or we leave now, or I stay here until the pregnancy is finished and I have my baby. Because I couldn't have a baby for 4 years after I married. I couldn't have any, and I was, and the doctor said, because I worked hard, I carried with my hand 60, 70 kilograms, my uterus was moved away four fingers. This is the way the doctor showed me, four fingers on the side. Mm. And I couldn't give, and this he said, it's from hard labor. And I knew, because I worked on the fields and I carried was cases with 60, 70 kilograms heaviness. So I was treating myself. I said the only thing to make good philosophies after family died is to have a child. And when I become pregnant, I said to my husband, or now, or who knows never, because I'm afraid of my baby. And we left the middle of the night with another group, like we used to arrange, in middle of the night, only a rucksack, backsack, you call it, 5 pair of panties and true slips and 5 blouses, whatever we could, to pass the border from Poland to Czechoslovakia. And when we arrived to Czechoslovakia, was waiting certain people for us, I walked through Czechoslovakia until Bratislava. Walked. You know? And from Bratislava, we had to go through Vienna. You know? Mm-hmm. To Vienna. Vienna was separated in 4 zones, and we won the American zone. So we had to pass the Russian zone. So people who had children put tape on their mouth. And at night we were going like this on hills, because down the hills there were patrols of Soviet soldiers. And if they are catching you, they're sending you back to Russia. So we had to go this little piece. So we arrived, and I had my mother with me. She wasn't so young anymore, and I remember she was, I was afraid I'd lose her. And when we came on the other side of the hill, we had reflectors, light waiting for us, the brigade, the Israeli guys were waiting for us. And they put us in a camp in from Vienna to Linz. In Linz, on the American zone, this was a concentration camp in the German time and a refugee camp after the war. There you were considered DP, displaced person. We got cards from the American zone that we are displaced person. There I gave birth to my daughter. And when she was 3 months old.
This was 1948.
Eight. In April, right in the beginning. Mm-hmm. They found out that my daughter has a hole in her heart. And until today, this is the first time I sang it in the tape. I never talked to her. Maybe the reason that we walked 25 miles, I don't remember, 45 miles to Czechoslovakia, I walked. Secondly, the scare I had in my heart when going on this mountain wall through to Vienna, that she was born with a defect. She doesn't know that. I say, something I went through in the time I was pregnant, something terrible went through. We were afraid they will send us back. You know, this is, it was something terrible. Everybody was really scared to death only to see us over this mountain. And when we came the other side, it was fantastic. We still lived in a barrack. It was not luxury, but we get food from the UNRWA and the joint, send it clothing and something to eat. And then 48 May, the Israel was, independence of Israel was declared. Mm-hmm. And in August 48, I took a backpack with a pillow inside, nothing, no clothing, nothing, a pillow with my little baby on my hand. And I went through the mountains, through Innsbruck, walking again through Italy. On every station were waiting Jewish people with fruits, with bread, waiting for these trains with refugees. Mm. And then from there we took a boat, Italian boat, Campidoglio. I'll remember it till my death. I had papers with my husband with the name Rabinovich, and the baby in my pillow was a little boy, but it was a girl. But on my false documents, I had a little boy who will open up and see 4 months baby if it's... And they told us, If the British are stopping in the middle of the, on the Mediterranean, don't speak any Yiddish. They know that this ship is Greek Jews who survived. You can talk only with your hands. And we arrived at night to Jaffa. They took us by little boats to the shore, and they put us again in a camp, tent camp. I was in this tent camp for 4 months.
In Jaffa?
In the north, Ranana. From Jaffa was the port.
Mm-hmm.
But in the same night, they took away, when you arrived, they took away my husband to the war, to the, in the army. This is the, I mean, the beginning of a better time. It was very bad in 48. We still had ration cards for food. We were in a tent with the shackles around, hyenas around. We heard the night, the laughing hyenas around this place. And I was all the time with my little one in my hands, because the doctor said, if she will live a year, you have to say thank you to God. And she's now a mother of two sons. She went through surgery in University of Pennsylvania.
And the hole was repaired?
A Dacron patch.
Oh.
They put on her hole.
Fantastic.
On her heart. And she's a Hebrew teacher now. She's a fantastic woman, lady, daughter. I can say she's a really down to earth person. And my other kids, the same thing. They're fantastic, good kids.
Now, you lived in Israel then for how long?
Almost 15 years. My son is born in Israel. The only one who was not born in Israel is my daughter. The one. And from my son was born in Haifa. And we went through, we left the Ranana, they sent us to Akko. There was a town occupied by all, it was empty, the Arabs ran away. Because if somebody says that the Israelis pushed out the Arabs from the country, I am the first to say, I'm going to say that it's not true. I saw with my own eyes one Arab shooting a neighbor because he doesn't want to run away. They forced him, one further, let us go away, we soon come back and take over again. This was the mentality. They left all of almost villages, towns, houses, they were free, they were empty. Nobody was there. So when a lot of Jewish refugees came in, they occupied these houses and they lived in them. This was the occupation, not because they occupied Israel. It's a different way, because I know that. I came to a woman from Greece, and we told her, look, the house will be taken away by the government because nobody is living in that. It's their children. If you give us a room to stay, us being there, nobody will touch you. Because if a house stays empty and people live on the streets and in tents, they have to occupy to put the people in, because right away they took the men away in war. They had to put the wives with the kids somewhere. So this was the way of exchanging, putting refugees in houses that were freed from people who ran away from the country. That's the whole idea. They used to go with armored cars, brought bread to the people in the houses, because people were afraid to go out buying bread. It was Arabs in the streets, or Arab could shoot from the roof, you never know. So they were standing in the houses, and the armor car were giving the bread to the people. Then they gave me a little Arab house, not house, I wouldn't say house, like a shed with no windows. Do you know Arab houses don't have windows? Because they don't want